Data Mesh Radio is provided as a free community resource from DataStax. Welcome to Data Mesh Radio, produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the founder of the Data Mesh Learning Community. Data Mesh Radio is a vendor-independent resource for learning more about Data Mesh. Let's jump in. In this episode, I had a great conversation with Olivier Volverek, senior consultant at Octo Technology, about schema contracts and how crucial they are to maintaining trust in a data mesh environment so that consumers know that the data that they're going to get hasn't, the underlying data product hasn't changed and that the semantic meaning or format also hasn't changed underneath them. I asked Olivier to discuss schema contracts as he had wrote a great post back on them in June of this year, 2021. So that link to that post is in the show notes as well. If you aren't familiar with schema contracts, Olivier gives a great overview, and I'd say listen to his over mine, but a quick and dirty definition is a data product producer creates a contract that guarantees their data product will serve data in a certain way. Not just the format like JSON or whatever of the data, but the actual semantic meaning and you know, within the schema as well. A consumer is able to kind of sign to that contract and have reasonable assurances that the data product will serve data as it's prescribed in the schema contract. If that data product is going to change, then that contract is broken. But the consumer is at least able to trace why things have changed, in what ways they've changed. And there's also, we need to allow for versioning so that we can enable data products to evolve within Data Mesh. So somebody doesn't automatically or suddenly have the data that they were relying on is no longer in the same format that they were expecting. But that we, again, still allow for that evolution as we provide those kind of versioning and move people to new and newer versions. Olivier also shared some tales of the fun of frequent schema contract breakage when the data producers are not bought in to doing data as a product. And we discussed some general approaches to how you might manage your schema contracts. I also throw in a little bit of my crazy brain concepts of can we actually have schema contracts where we're tracking at kind of a column level, lineage level, so that people can just move to the newer version if nothing has really changed for them. Schema contracts are a very emerging topic, so look forward to many more conversations around this. And there's also a great video from Sophia Tania of ThoughtWorks presenting about data mesh testing that includes a bit about schema contracts. And so I'm linking that as well in the show notes. This episode will probably leave you with more questions than concrete answers, but I think it's well worth your time. This is a really, really important aspect of data mesh. And I think we all need to circle up and figure out how to get this right. So with that said, let's jump into another great episode of Data Mesh Radio. With that bottom line up front done, let's go ahead and jump into this interview. Okay, welcome. I've got an awesome guest here today. I've got Olivier Volverek. Tell me if I got that right, but
excellent.
from Octo, and we're going to be talking about schema contracts and kind of how that all fits in within Data Mesh. But Olivier, if you could give a little bit of an intro about yourself and then about Octo and kind of what you are doing with Data Mesh and what Octo as well is doing with Data Mesh.
Okay. Thank you, Scott, for having me. I'm Olivier. I'm a senior consultant for, I'm working for Octo Technology in France, which is a service company. And we help the customers to be the best in what they do in their business, to grow their business, thanks to the technology, to digital technology. That's the job of Octo Technology. And within Octo, I am helping the customers to bring value thanks to their data. So this means that I'm doing data architecture. I may do data engineering because we are a dirty consultant. We are just making our hands dirty, helping customers. We help customers. We say what they need, they can do to improve their business, and we help them doing this. We have both stuff. And at Octo, we are now we have the strong conviction that the data mesh is a paradigm that people should investigate to get a lot of benefits and a lot of extract value from their data. We are talking a lot of our customers, big customers, are thinking about being data-driven. And being data-driven is, we think it can be set as a reality thanks to the data mesh. So within Octo, I am following the data mesh community, the data mesh practices from the client. I am concentrating them inside Octo, and I try to federate all the initiatives we are doing around the data, from the machine learning to the analytics and other stuff, and federate all this initiative with the data mesh. And we try to sell this initiative to the customers and say, okay, you want to be data driven, let us try to understand your problems, what is your business, and see if the data mesh can fit and help you address those your problems and help you be the best in your business.
Yeah, and I think that there are a lot of people out there who want kind of a here is the blueprint for data mesh versus here. Yeah. We need to adapt it for your specific circumstances in your organization, and it's not right for everyone. And, I have a lot of people who think for some reason that I think everybody should do data mesh. It's like, no.
Absolutely not. This is the point. We try to first to understand the business problems and say to see if the business can be better with data. And if the current situation of the centralized data, the monolith with the data lake, answered those business problems. And if it's not, maybe we could decentralize, and maybe data mesh is an answer to this, to those problems.
Exactly.
And if it's an answer, then we do some assessments, and we try to build some architecture and basic. We take basic use cases, simple use cases, and try to make them grow to eventually end to a complete data mesh architecture within the system. But as data mesh is new, there is no true customer journey that is ending through to a complete data mesh structure right now in any of our customers, obviously.
I think there's probably no companies in the world that are really, like, when you really, Zalando is pretty far along, DPG Media, we had Juanes on the podcast as well this week, who, recently moved on from DPG Media, but I don't think anybody's really kind of at that complete stage. So I'm going to definitely ask you to come back to talk about those assessments and how we do that. But for today, we were looking at talking about what schema contracts and how you think about those contracts within, relative to a data product and how they evolve and what are kind of the differences between those and API contracts. So it might help people to start with what is your kind of definition of what a schema contract is, or what if somebody's not really super familiar with that, how would you explain it to them?
I would first separate two layers within the contract, and this is important because a lot of people, when I'm going into companies and I try to speak about contracts and definitions of the data to exchange, they say, oh, we are doing JSON, or we are doing protobuf, or we are doing Avro. And this is not a schema contract. I mean, this is a way to serialize the data.
It's a format.
Contract. It's the wire. It's the way you send the elements. So basically, Avro, JSON, protobuf, whatever is not definitely, even JSON schema is not a contract. It's a way to express, is DSL to express a contract. The contract, the data contract, to me is what is the definition and the semantic of the data that express what the data actually means within a context. And you express the semantic of the data in your context. This data means, for example, if you take whatever, if you take the weight of a person, you mean the weight of a person is the weight as measured in the morning. In my contract, the weight means exactly that as measured in the morning when you didn't hit anything. And you express this element, the weight, this is your contract. I would say the weight is in kilogram, the unit, and then you find a language to serialize it, to express it in a so it can be understood by a computer. But at first, a contract is something that is human understandable. It's going out of the domain where there is within the domain there is this ubiquitous language, and from this ubiquitous language you describe your data, and the data you will expose outside of your domain, the semantic is basically your contract, and you have the semantic and the constraints, obviously. And then this is your contract. And then once you have the semantic at your constraint, you find a technological way to express it, a domain-specific language, and you serialize it, and you express those definition and those constraints in a format that is understandable and serializable, so it can be transmitted from a domain to another in a technological way.
And the contract concept is that you're guaranteeing that you'll continue to serve that data in that format, correct? Or in that with all those constraints, not just JSON, but that you're going to be serving the data in kilograms, and that it means X, Y, and Z, you know, that it's at the time of day and that it's, measured in this specific way. It's that right? Is that the way you're thinking about it as well?
Yes, absolutely. And this is when you come. So this is the contract, and then you add an extra information. You may add an extra information. A contract can be version. You can have a version of a contract, and this is important because it ensures that the data you're transmitting from a domain to another. Because you can change the definition at a certain point. You may need to change the definition at a certain point. And if you change the definition, you have to ensure the compatibility, and you have to understand the contract basically is made to be sure that a consumer domain is autonomous to use the data and understand the data without any noise.
Basically that it's not going to change underneath them without them knowing, right?
That's exactly.
The contract concept, I think, in this. I don't really like the word contract for it, but it is the word that's out there because you're going to break your contract, right? When things change, you're going to do that. And that's where you're talking about versioning. And I think that's really important within Data Mesh is that we have data product evolution, right? And so things may change, and but when you've got a contract, at least people that it's not just like a pub sub type of model where, oh, something's changed underneath me and I don't know that it's coming. If there's a good contract system for tracking who is actually, you know, subscribing in what way to what data and that, that you can alert them that changes may be coming, or that you can make that transitioning from one version to the next of a data product much easier, because they know, you know, you're kind of your own SLA is that you will be explaining what data is in here. So if somebody has to move to a new version, they can more easily update what they're going to be consuming, and that they, again, you are going to potentially break these contracts. But when you go from one version of the data schema to another, but that there is a mechanism for understanding what's happened, when it happened, why it happened, and that there's also an ability for somebody to say, hey, I don't really understand what's changed here. Like, help walk me through it. Because it's, again, that data product owner concept within Data Mesh. If you have a contract, you have a second party versus you're a subscriber. You don't really have a great relationship with the publisher.
Yeah, that's it. It's a loosely coupling between the subscriber and the publisher. But if we take back the notion of a contract, underneath there's an agreement. When you do a contract, it's basically an agreement, and you agree that two domains, two products can communicate if you respect the contract. I expose my contract. My data would be this format with these constraints, with this meaning. You expose, you ensure that any consumer is able to consume the data and understands the data. And this notion of contract, even if I don't like the word either, but this notion of contract ensure that the mesh can work, because if you break the contract at a certain point, you break the link between the domains. You can't just ensure that the producer and the consumer can't communicate anymore, and therefore they can't communicate. You break the link of the mesh, and you don't have a mesh anymore. You have a set of autonomous data products or data domains, and this is not what we want. We want autonomy for the domains, but we want a mesh. We want the domains to communicate together, and to be able to communicate, we need a contract, and we need with this contract, we have a notion of trust. I can trust the data. I trust your data. I trust your the meaning of your data. I trust your constraint. I know that you won't publish. Whatever data. I don't have any good example. I have one I've used, but it is related to. I work for a company that is selling sports goods, and we set up a contract. The contract was we want to send the size of the arm, the size of the arm of the biceps, is that the correct name in English? Yeah, the muscle, the biceps. The size of the biceps is measured 5 centimeters from the elbow. So I send you the size of the biceps as measured 5 centimeters from the elbow. This is my contract, and this ensures that the whole company gets the correct element. And if I want the size of an arm, I can consume it right from my domain. Everybody understands the same. This is my contract. If all of a sudden I change the measure of the biceps, I say from 5 to 4 centimeters, I break my contract, and then the trust relationship from the source, the data producer, is broken, and then all the consumer data won't to be able to do their job anymore, and then we've just messed up with the data mesh, and we don't have a data mesh anymore because we've broken the contract.
Yeah, there's a word that I'm using that's kind of a blanket statement for all of the kind of DATIS stuff that Jamak has talked about for what a data product must be. But for me, it's usability. And usability means, understandability, ability to access, this is what all data products must have. But a big one of that is that trustability and repeatability. So exactly what you're talking about is I can trust that this data means what I think it means, yeah. Right? And that's somewhat understandable, but it's also like, okay, there's an SLA that's defined that tells me what,
yeah.
how well they are conforming to this. It's 99.9% accuracy, yeah. or it's, but there's also that repeatability. Bill Schmarzo was talking about, I think that's how you say his name, was talking about, he is trying to think of how valuable a piece of data is or a data set is based on how often it's reused, which I think in data mesh kind of works, kind of doesn't, because you can keep swimming upstream to get to the source. But when you think about that reuse, that repeatability, that you know that this data isn't going to change without you understanding when it's going to change and why it's going to change, that repeatability and that trustability that you don't have to go and say, is this clean data?
Yeah,
is exactly. this, does this data mean the same thing that it meant last month that it does this month? Because I can see that contract, that removes so much friction and headaches and just yeah. problems around yeah. is my data clean? And so, yeah, I think this contract concept is really helpful. I am kind of wondering how we might even evolve this contract concept around a couple of different things. And I'd love to get your thoughts on this. One is that we almost have micro contracts where you think about, I'm not talking about my schema for the entire data product, but I'm talking about my schema maybe at even the column level, and that somebody can subscribe to that. So if you go from version 12 to version 13 of the data product, but there isn't any change for the consumer of what they were consuming from the data product, they can jump straight to version 13. It's automatic that it moves them there because there isn't a change for them. And then the other concept that I'd love to think about, or and this is just something I've been working on in my head, but of how do you think about who are your consumers so that you can almost do internal data product marketing around, we're not augmenting anything, so it doesn't matter that you're going from version 12 to version 13 because we're not changing anything that's existing, mm-hmm. but we've added additional data that we think you might want. So how do you think of that as kind of a registration system of who is actually registered from a contract consumer so that you can let them know that not just changes are coming, right? You don't just check it out and you check it in and somebody's, okay, you're still on the old version. And then what happens yeah. when they've got to migrate to the new, but that you can let them know something of value might be coming down the pipe for them. So a lot of info at you, whichever one you want to dig into, but.
To be honest, I don't know about the micro contracts. When I think, I'm coming from the operational world. I'm not from the analytical world. Mm-hmm. I came to the data mesh because I needed to. I wanted the operational world to that is generating data. Those data to be useful to the business in general, yeah. not just for a service. So in the operational world, we use for the operational API. We have this notion of contract for a long time. It exists mm-hmm. for a long time. And what we do, we use semantic versionings for the those tiny elements. When you're introducing a non-breaking change, you increment the lower number. And when you you add a feature, you increment the middle number. And when you break something, you may increment the the biggest number, the major number. I guess that at a certain point, this notion of micro contracts that you are speaking about, maybe you are. There are two ways to think about it. Even you create a meta contract with some with include of the micro contract in it, and this sounds quite difficult to maintain because you will end up with a dependency problem with your contract, and you will have to ensure that the all the elements are how to say that can be used together. Or you can use you get rid of the micro contract and you use a big contract and you use the versioning of your big contract. And if you do a minor changes in the contract, then if you do minor changes, you play with the version number of your top level contract. This is two different approaches. And I think that there is no good answer to that. It's the same way as do you need microservices against? Do you need a monolith? It really depends. It's the same stuff. Do you need a monorepo or do you need a multi-repository? Do you need it? It's the same. So if I understand correctly your question, which is not maybe I'm wrong, but I don't have any answer to that, to be honest, about this micro contract. I would go for the simplest one. So I wouldn't go with a micro contract. I wouldn't dig to an anatomic level. I wouldn't go to the column for a contract. I would keep a big contract for all the data coming from a data domain.
And I think where I'm thinking of this from is the tooling isn't there yet. No, somebody shouldn't implement the micro contract concept, but if we can push the tooling to go to that it's at the platform itself, you know, your data mesh platform is aware from who is consuming and what are they consuming. You know, when we're looking at data lineage tools, a lot of these are able to really understand at the column level what is, you know, what is being consumed, or you know, up and downstream as to where might your change have happened when you're thinking about, oh, this thing broke, like where you've got column level lineage. So if we think about that same column level lineage again, this would not be a manual thing. I should have stated that, because that micro contract thing would be horrible. But if your platform is aware via the same lineage concept of doing that from a contract standpoint, that somebody just transitions from version, you know, XYZ to version XYY or whatever it is, that you can just automatically move them to the next version without there being any human interaction, right? That they don't have to care. They don't have to go, is this change going to break anything? It just automatically moves them forward if it's not going to break them, because it's aware of their consumption patterns. The tooling isn't there. But this is kind of my crazy brained. I don't know if it's big brained or if it's just me being crazy and asking too much. Of if we have that column level lineage concept, could we embed that as well from a contract standpoint? But it's not there at all yet, but no, it's something that I would love to see, because then again, we're you know, the platform is there to make things easier for the data product producers and the data product consumers. If we make it so that the data product consumers don't even have to know that there was a change, because it doesn't impact them, then that to me, I think is super awesome. But like, it doesn't sound like you're seeing anything thus far where that's automatic, and that right now, I don't think that that's something that somebody who's implementing a data mesh, they're already taking on a lot that they might want to be doing, that they don't want to go down into that level.
Yeah, I like this kind of crazy idea you have, to be honest. I don't have any answer. I need to think about it. And I may, you know, this is how I work. I may do a proof of value or a proof of concept or on a small stuff to see if it's feasible and if we can get value from this. So thank you for bringing this to my attention, for opening the Pandora box. I may pass a couple of hours implementing and trying stuff like that. But I don't know, to be honest. For sure, I don't know any tooling that is able to do that, for sure. To be honest, the customers don't have the maturity yet to go down to this level. So I didn't face the need to implement stuff like that right now, but I definitely see that it would be a great benefit to have something like that if it does not bring complexity, if it's automatic enough and not complex. I mean, automatic but not magic. It does not bring complexity anymore. So I will think about it.
And that's where I feel like my ideas around what I would love to see with data mesh are putting too much burden on the data engineering team to build this platform that is magic, I guess that kind of, you're saying that you're not seeing necessarily that much of a need for it right now, or you haven't seen that as much. But how often maybe are you seeing that people are breaking their contracts with these with their data products? Like when people are evolving their data products, are you seeing very, very fast evolution, or are you seeing slow evolution, or?
To be honest, they break their contracts a lot. because for many reasons, because most of the companies I'm working for do not take the data mesh as a brand new starter for an organization. They're building a data mesh on top of something that is already existing, and they have to change their mentality. I'm implementing data mesh from the consumer, the data producer point of view, most of the time. This is the first domain, and this is probably the wrong way to do it. We should take an analytical use case and get the data. And anyway, one way or another, we need to get those data. And what happens most of the time is that they take their database schema, the operational database schema, and they say, okay, this is our data product and this is our data, and there's not a proper contract. This is just a database schema. The constraint is just driven by the database itself. So obviously, whenever they change the database for the need of the product, they break the contract. And it happens all the time, basically. This is sad. And this is what I hope data mesh will fix in the future. But to fix that, the people really need to change their paradigm and say, okay, we do not provide service and have data as a consequence. They need to think, we need those data, we build those data contracts, and as a consequence, we may provide some product or value that allow them to bring the data. And not to break the contract, they need to think about the data contract in the first place. Then they need to think, what will be the data contract I will expose to the organization, and not what is the data I may get from this service I already exposed to my customers. This is the change. If they do that, we may have stable contracts, because the contract will be designed from the very beginning of the data domain. If we don't design the data contract at the very beginning, it's a consequence of what we already have. And as a consequence, it may break all the time because it's something that is not intended to be shared at first place.
Yeah, there are a couple of points there. One is, you talked about the kind of data as a byproduct instead of data as a product, and that, which is, it does take that mindset shift. And so thinking about what does, within data mesh analytics is a first order concern. And so you have to get the domains bought in that it's a first order concern because it's still not necessarily there. So if you're just implementing it as a, as kind of a, again, the byproduct, and you're doing your best to create these analytical products, it's going to be tough. But the other aspect, well, actually there are three. One, the second one is about how do we, I think this is at the tooling level again, but it does factor in a lot on the, socio-technical, the sociology side, the people process side. How do we think about what are my changes in the operational plane going to do for the data plane? And that we think about, I'm checking this schema out into, whatever I'm doing, and I'm going to be updating it. I can see who's going to be impacted downstream.
Yeah.
And that I that they're brought in on the Jira or Confluence or whatever ticket page, whatever you're using, to so they're aware that a change may be coming, and so that they can prepare for that, or they can have that conversation back and forth as to, hey, we are a first class consumer. As much as the application is the first class consumer, we are also a first class consumer. I haven't seen a ton around the tech there. And then the third one is something that I'm starting to see more and more from people that are digging more and more into data mesh, that they're getting a little bit more frustrated because of exactly what you're talking about, of we're still not winning over the domains as to that they have to care all that much in a lot of places. So do we start to think about application development from the start, not just, what are we going to be serving as data and that data contract at the start, but do we start from developing our application around the data from the start so that it is so closely linked? But then if you think about that, and you think about an ML model, and you think about, all sorts of data that may be coming from a large scale application, how huge does your team get, right? Like how bounded is this context? So again, I have this problem where I talk too much in multiple points, but would love to dig into any of those things that you find interesting or useful that you'd like to talk more about.
I wanted to expose something I tried with for a contract at first, because when you draw a context map in the DDD, you try to evaluate the link you have between the domains, and most of the time you want them to be lossily coupled. So I tried something for a company first, and this is an article I blogged about it. It appears in the Data Mesh newsletter a couple of months ago. I wanted to say maybe we can expose the contract and validate when we publish the data, just take a wire, or just take a PubSub or a Kafka, whatever. I wanted to validate the data first before putting it on the wire. This is something I wanted to say. I used the Q language for this because it was easy to express the schema, the contract, DSL, and to validate the data. And this is something I wanted to say, okay, you want to you expose your data contract. This is your contract in Q language, whatever language it is, but Q was easy. So you have your constraints, you say you need, and you expose your semantic with the comments. And when you want to produce some data, put them on the wire to expose them on your data mesh, there is a first step that is the validation. And if the validation fails, your data doesn't appear on the data mesh. Your data, you as a producer, get an error because your data is not valid. And the problem with data quality is at the ownership of the domain. So I say, okay, this may be a solution. I expose a contract. When I put the data, all the data that will be exposed to the mesh are obviously coherent with the contract. This didn't work because none of the domains wanted this constraint, because they didn't want to deal with, say, okay, I don't want our first, they didn't want the Q language, but that was a proof of concept. Anyway, that was not a problem. But I didn't want to say, okay, I want to put the data. If the data fails, I have to handle the dead letter Q and whatever problem I had. They didn't want to deal with that. They just wanted to say, okay, I put a sync on my data, data domain. I send all the data. And whoever wants to use the data, they use the data. If the data is not does not have good quality, okay, they will come back to me. Maybe I will fix it somehow. Right. And this didn't work. That is a huge problem. And once again, it's a problem. We can set the tooling to do that. I made the proof of concept. Well, maybe it was not bulletproof, but the tooling was okay. But the problem was the ownership and the socio-technical problem. The people did not want to, they were building a product, and what it was important was a product. And they say, okay, you want my data, I give you my data, but don't ask me to work on my data. The data works for me, and that is enough. And this is basically the problem we have. So we need contracts, but we need a strong governance to say it. I had the seldom pleasure to speak with a company that has implemented data mesh, and obviously they will do a talk soon. I will put you in contact, Scott, okay. Because I think the lead architect has a lot to say. They managed to do this because they had a strong governance that say, now you have to respect the rules. Before exposing the data, you need to validate their quality against your contract. And this worked. And this is the basic rule. This is the rule of success. The tooling is not a problem.
It's that trust. It's that reliability. It's the usability. Yeah. It's that if you don't have the people who are upstream that care, you're always going to have problems because they're the ones who can detect. I've actually been trying to push, data stacks, with their Astra offerings. Cause it's, both Apache Cassandra and Apache Pulsar. And, we're now doing like CDC with Pulsar, that I want to do data quality checks before you put it even onto the Pulsar queue itself, and that, does that inject latency, but that you offer the ability to do that, that there is a quality check. I talked with a company called Telmai, and they're really the only one that I'm familiar of that's really doing data observability and data quality monitoring in any real sense for data in motion. And to me, that's kind of insane that nobody's doing that, because there are a lot of systems now and a lot of setups at companies where they don't ever land it into a Snowflake or Databricks or whatever, that it's only in Kafka. So how do you not have this validation? And when you think about data mesh aside, when you think about like something like ML, where you might be reacting on data that doesn't conform, and so it could cause major issues if you're pushing that into that system that where it's reacting in real time. It's not training your model, it's the actual like model implementation. Like, how are we not thinking about pushing that further and further up the stack of that observability and that monitoring, and that we create a way for the entire organization to do that. And that is at the platform level, right? That we don't want everybody to have to implement this stuff individually, but how do we push those concepts further and further left? Not just, okay, you now own the data, but we're also going to make it easy for you to own the data. And we're going to make it that this actually has value for yourself as well. There's kind of an interesting trend where some companies are mandating that the domains themselves, if they're going to consume analytical data, they actually have to consume from the same products as the same, you know, data mesh data products as the general populace, you know. Yeah. So they have to dog food is the English idiom around that of you have to use what you're producing others. Yeah. And
eat your own dog food. I know that.
But I don't love that concept as well. I'm going to do a mesh musing where I kind of just talk about that concept because, you know, there may be specific instances where that domain doesn't need to share this other data and they do need to do analytics around it. And doesn't make sense to share it to others. It could be. So I like it and I don't. There's pros and cons to it. But I think what you're talking about is these data contracts are only as good as the word of the person signing the contract.
Yeah, exactly. This is an excellent conclusion.
So do you have advice for people that are in the, let's say that they're in the state that you are, where the domains aren't as bought in around how these contracts might work? You know, for a consumer, are they just kind of, you know, SOL, which we'll pretend means shoot out of luck in this context, but that they're just kind of stuck with what it is, and they'll at least know that they're why their data is broken. Yeah. Do you have advice for somebody that's kind of in that situation?
I think that we're talking data mesh for large companies. I think that they need to find a proper use case, an analytical use case or a machine learning use case or whatever use case that is in the analytical world that may benefit a lot to the company. Once they have that, and that may use their data, and then all of a sudden within the domain, they will realize that their data can bring to the company as much value as the service that they provide. And as a data producer, which is basically usually in the transactional world or operational world, they will soon realize that there are two ways to consume their value, one from the operation they will provide to the end user, and from the data as well. And then they will start to build their contract of the data, because they will need their data to be consumed by this analytical use case to bring value to the company. Because at the very end, they all need to bring value to, if the company is getting well, the domain is getting well, obviously. Yeah. So my goal is talk to the people and find a very good analytical use case that will benefit from the data. And then all of a sudden, you will have the analytical world and the operational world that will work together. And to work together, they will have to go through this contract. And then if it's a valuable circle, maybe other people will want to consume the data. And we have this famous net promoter score of the data. And we'll see that other people, and this will eventually end up in a complete data mesh. But first, find the analytical use case that may benefit from your operational data, and set up a contract in between. That will be your totem to
I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think that's great advice. So, I think we're kind of about at time here, but is there anything else that we didn't cover around schema contracts or kind of that we touched on today that you wanted to elaborate more on? Or if not, where can people find you if they want to get in touch? You know,
you can find me on the Slack, the Data Mesh Learning Slack community. I'm usually there. You can I will send you the link of my professional email. Do not hesitate to send me an email. I may answer when I have time. If I don't answer, you can ping me on Twitter. I'm really very active on Twitter, so do not hesitate. And I'm really happy to discuss with people because I think that this data mesh, it's the very beginning of a long story. So do not hesitate to share your experiences, to discuss, to disagree with all that I said. And I think that we'll move the data world into the good direction. So, and thank you once again, Scott. Yeah. For everything you do to this for this community, so I take this opportunity to thank you very much because, I mean, you bring a lot to this community and obviously to me as well. So thank you very much.
Well, and thank you. You've been a great community member, and we'll drop all that information of how to get in touch with Olivier into the show notes. We'll drop the link about the. Of the blog post that he had made about using QLang and that as to kind of doing those validation up front rather than, you found out you broke your contract. It's like, this will break your contract. Let's not do that. I think that's all great. And I look forward to continuing with conversations between us and with the community. So with that, I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in today and, hopefully this was as interesting and useful for you as it was for me. And, you know, we'll look forward to the next episode coming up soon. I again want to thank my awesome guest, Olivier Volverek from Octo Technology. If you want to get in touch with Olivier, as he mentioned, you can find him in the Data Mesh Learning Slack, or you can get his email, Twitter, LinkedIn in the show notes. If you have thoughts or feedbacks on this episode or want to suggest topics for future Data Mesh Radio content, please see the show notes for exactly how to do that. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Data Mesh Radio. Hopefully it was useful to you. If you'd like to connect with the show, you can find us on LinkedIn or Twitter. If you'd like to connect with me, you can do the same. If you have feedback, or especially if you'd like to be a guest, we've got some links in the show notes to tell you how to do that. Love to hear what questions people have and how I can be useful. And then this is provided as a free community resource by DataStax. So please do stick around after the music if you'd like to hear more about what DataStax is offering with their serverless managed version of Cassandra. Data Mesh Radio is a free community resource provided by DataStax. If you're not aware, I'm actually employed by DataStax, and they've allowed me to be a resource for the general data community, learning about data mesh, data as a product, and other related topics. If you're not aware, DataStax has made a lot of pretty big, interesting changes in the last few years. They now offer a multi-region, very performant, serverless database offering with a number of easy to develop for APIs with like gRPC, JSON, GraphQL, REST. You know, if you'd like to learn more, check them out. You can check out their AstraDB offering, and you can use the code DAAP500. That's DAAP500. Or data as a product 500 to get $500 of free credits. You can also check out what they're doing with streaming. It's pretty interesting.